Hello and welcome to Next 2.0 on WQLN NPR. Next is produced by the Public's Voice Media. I am your host, Marcus Atkinson, and I'm flying solo today. If you want to know more about Next 2.0, go to Facebook, like the page, follow us on Instagram at Next 2.0 Erie. There you can keep up with upcoming show promos, events, and clips about what's next for our communities and our democracy. Thank you so much for tuning in. Happy holidays to you. As you're listening to this, more than likely it is after Christmas and before New Year's, and so you're throwing away all the torn wrapping paper, you're putting bows back in boxes, you still got the cards on the wall because that usually makes it through New Year's Day, and you're now pulling out the noisemakers and the tinsel and the decorations. The liquor bottles are coming out of the cabinet, you're pulling out cocktail recipes, and you're getting ready for New Year's Eve for the ball to drop. And while you're making that transition, I wanted to give you something fun to listen to, because I know at this time of year, everyone is asking, what's your favorite Christmas show? Is it a movie? Is it a TV show? And you hear some of the usual suspects come up. You hear somebody mention Home Alone, and yes, that was good. Somebody will mention Elf, and I love that. When he's singing Baby It's Cold Outside in the shower is one of my favorite parts. You'll hear all of these Hallmark movies and some one-off movies that maybe you love. First Holiday or Last Holiday by Queen Latifah. All of these different things will come up. But my favorite is usually uttered by the masses when you ask them what your favorite holiday show is. And mine would be How the Grinch Stole Christmas. Yes. Now, in one of the previous episodes, I told you I grew up Jehovah's Witnesses. We didn't celebrate Christmas. And so for me, the idea of this person going to steal Christmas from people was kind of funny because it was such a big deal. There was a little jealousy, a little envy on my part as a kid because I missed Christmas. But the whole premise was fun. It was funny. It was a little scary when I was younger. And the Grinch had that big, long, wide, curly, wicked smile after he decided to steal Christmas, and his hair kind of parts and sticks out straight on the side like horns. That was kind of scary. But the show itself was just so much fun. The music, the voices, the characters, the plot. I almost had an attitude when he gave Christmas back. He took it so masterfully. But I want to outline a handful of things about that show that I bet you didn't know. As I researched all things Grinch and all things that animated special, I found a lot of things that were very fascinating, very interesting. But I extracted the things that really, really pulled me in the most. And I wanted to give you a couple of those things as you're preparing yourselves for New Year's so that we can all have fun with this. And maybe you'll scratch your head a little bit and say, I didn't know that. Let's start with the obvious of who this person is that gave us this classic. Theodore Seuss Giselle, who was known for his work writing and illustrating more than 60 books under the pen name Dr. Seuss. Sold over 600 million copies, and it was translated into more than 20 languages by the time of his death in 1991 at the age of 87. There were a few times that the Grinch was mentioned in Dr. Seuss writings. The first was in 1956. It was a book called Scrambled Eggs Super. This was about Peter T. Hooper, who was a boy who collected eggs from a number of exotic birds to make scrambled eggs. Now, one of those exotic birds is the beagle-beaked, bald-headed Grinch, who shares the same cantankerous, ornery attitude as the Grinch that we all know and love. That was kind of the first iteration. The second mention, which wasn't really an iteration, appeared in a 1955 issue of Red Book magazine. This was a 32-line poem called The Hubbub and the Grinch. Now, this Grinch had no resemblance whatsoever to the character that we're talking about now from The Grinch That Stole Christmas. Instead, it was more of a fast-talking salesman that was kind of like the Sylvester McMonkey McBean character from The Sneetches, if you remember that. And then, of course, the book How the Grinch Stole Christmas made its debut in 1957, and in 1966, it was adapted into the animated television featurette that has inspired this podcast. It was initially published by Random House Books and Red Book Magazine. Now, the Red Book Magazine connection is interesting unto itself. Most of us know it as a women's magazine. that launched several decades ago. As I went further and further down that rabbit hole, there were way too many things to try to bring out in this episode. So to stay focused on the Grinch connection, I'll just say that there were 23 documented issues of Red Book magazine from the 50s that contained Dr. Seuss stories. All of these were original stories except for the Grinch. And this goes from 1950 with the first one, Gustav the Goldfish, and it runs all the way through 1957, which is How the Grinch Stole Christmas. Hubbub and the Grinch that I talked about earlier, that one debuted May 1955. And so the Red Book magazine connection is certainly a fascinating when you think about the way they have, we got Beetle Bailey and other cartoons from the Sunday comics. It feels like the Red Book magazine and Dr. Seuss relationship had a similar theme. Dr. Seuss would come out with these clever poems and short stories with these clever characters, and Red Book published them, and they grew in popularity based in large part on that relationship. Let's talk about the money. Dr. Seuss with the Grinch That Stole Christmas was the second big ticket animated special for CBS at that time. It was in 1966. The first one, in 1965, was a Charlie Brown Christmas. That was the first primetime animated special. Then CBS and Coca-Cola combined to give the Charlie Brown Christmas team a $76,000 budget to produce this special. Now, it was very tough to pin down what kind of money it made for the network at that time, but what it did give was this particular fact. It debuted on December 9th, 1965, and at that time, 15 million households, 15 million, tuned in to watch that special. That's almost half of all American households in 1965. It went on to win a Peabody and an Emmy. And so A Charlie Brown Christmas did something that CBS never anticipated. You scour the internet, they were really, really preparing themselves for a flop. There's a whole story behind that, but no such thing. They kicked the doors in. Enter Seuss and his team for the Grinch That Stole Christmas that following year. They gave them a budget of $315,000. To produce this animated special. I want to put that in context for you. That's almost $3 million in today's money. Put it in further context. If you go back to 1965 and 1966, check the ratings on television and see what show was number one. Bonanza. Bonanza was number one. That show lasted 14 seasons. But the first few seasons, it cost $110,000 per episode to shoot Bonanza. And I want you to think about all the celebrities, the would-be celebrities, and even some established celebrities that were in that show at the time. $110,000 per episode, even closer to its peak in the 14th season. The episode cost was about $225,000 per episode. The most popular show on television. And here they were given $315,000 to produce A Grinch That Stole Christmas. And so they owe Charlie Brown a solid for their largesse in their budget. Let's talk about the sponsors back then. So now the way we do sponsorships is every commercial, there's a different player. And those spots vary depending on the day and time, the length, so on and so forth. Back then, they would only have a key sponsor. When How the Grinch Stole Christmas first aired in 1966 on December 18th, it was sponsored solely by the Foundation for Full Service Banks. And that was edited out of every broadcast after the first one. So I want you to think about this. Bankers were the key advertiser, the key sponsors, the ones who underwrote How the Grinch Stole Christmas. And the show is about, Christmas isn't about gifts. It's not about commercialism. It's not about money. It's about the feeling that you have in your heart for the holiday, for your neighbors. And Bankers underwrote that message. That would not, in my opinion, would not happen today because today, more than ever in history, cash and commercialization is king. Everything is being commercialized. I thought that was interesting, man, that a bank did that. Let's talk about the voices of the Grinch That Stole Christmas. The narrator and the Grinch are both the same voice. Now, if you aren't older, this may not strike you as fascinating as it is to me, and maybe, you know, some people around my uncles and parents' ages, but Boris Karloff was the iconic voice behind the Grinch and the narration. If you're a little younger, you may know Boris Karloff as his role as the original Frankenstein's monster. Let's just say Frankenstein, because it's something how when you mention Frankenstein, people automatically go to the monster. They assume that the monster's name is Frankenstein. That wasn't it. The monster was Frankenstein's monster. But Boris Karloff, in that original Frankenstein movie, played the monster. He also played the mummy. So he was a big deal at that time. And still is a reason why the popularity of it is so timeless. If you go to the voices of the characters, little Cindy Lou Who, I love this character. Santa Claus, oh Santa Claus, why are you taking our Christmas tree? Oh, that scene brought tears to my eyes when I was a kid. Cindy Lou Who is voiced by a lady by the name of June Foray. If you ever watched Rocky and Bullwinkle, that old school cartoon, she was the voice of Rocky the Flying Squirrel. And she voiced a ton of other characters as well. They actually referred to her as the female Mel Blanc, and others referred to Mel Blanc as the male June Foray. Mel Blanc is known for the Bugs Bunny universe and all of those different voices. Another voice that was popular in that, Thurl Ravenscroft, provided the bass voice in the classic song that we all love. My niece just called the other day. My little brother Jason put my niece on the phone, and she was singing "You're a Mean One," Mr. Grinch. He was also, Thurl Ravenscroft was also the original voice of Tony the Tiger. You listen to him singing "The Mean One, Mr. Grinch," and the original Tony Tiger, you can hear that same growl and that strong bass voice. These are the voices that made up The Grinch That Stole Christmas, the voices that hooked so many of us in love in this show. The Grammys have a category called Best Children's Album. In 1968, the winner was Dr. Seuss for How the Grinch Stole Christmas. And the voice of Boris Karloff was so synonymous with this show that they actually gave the award to Karloff. And to add to the popularity of this song in a day and age where you have YouTube and all these other streaming services that bring old songs to the forefront and they make them new again and they make them hot again, Billboard was inundated in 2020 with the song "You're a Mean One, Mr. Grinch," and it hit Billboard's top 100, charted all the way up to number 32 in 2020. So a whole new generation has learned to love this song, kind of like Running Up That Hill on the Netflix giant hit Stranger Things. It's interesting how the more things change, the more they stay the same, especially with technology. That's how popular that song continues to be. The story itself, even though the special was only about 25 minutes without commercials, if you go back to the original Dr. Seuss book, the book wasn't that robust. It didn't have that much source material. And so as you're watching that original special, the scene where the Grinch and Max descend from up on Mount Crumpet down to Whoville was actually put in there to pad the story because it wasn't long enough to make a television special. Can't speak for you. It's one of my favorite parts, man. When he looks down over that crowded sleigh and you see Max hanging there by the rope. Too classic. But it was thrown in there because the book wasn't long enough. Bet you didn't know that. For a long time, you can count on CBS trotting out How the Grinch Stole Christmas for the holidays. They aired it around Christmas every single year through 1987. But again, through the rise of cable, hypermedia, you start to see a diversification of its airing. After that, after 1987, It started to air on different channels such as TNT, TBS, the WB, and ABC. Currently, NBC owns the right to air it. So this thing has been passed around extensively. You go back to the voice thing a second ago and the significance of someone like a Boris Karloff reading the lines for The Grinch and narrating. In a modern day sense, I want you to think about, take James Earl Jones's voice out of the role of Mufasa and tell me The Lion King would be as good. Take Vincent Price's voice out of Thriller. Let somebody else do that long speech at the end of Thriller. Tell me the song would have been as good. Voices matter. And so Boris Karloff was a huge win for the series. And while I'm thinking about it, let me throw this fact in here too. The original Grinch was penned in black and white. Black and white. In that 1966 era, color television was all the rave. One of the producers of The Grinch had rented a car, and it was this real ugly green that kind of stuck in his brain. And they decided, let's make The Grinch pop. Let's make him green. As a matter of fact, let's use that green that you talked about from your rental car. And so the color of The Grinch, which is now, you know, is synonymous with The Grinch, was born. But at the time, in the beginning, with just a black and white depiction. But again, the voices matter so much to the success of it. Let's talk about the story. And so in terms of popularity, currently the television special has a 100% rating on Rotten Tomatoes. On top of that, the TV Guide ranks it as the best holiday special of all time. And so in 2000, Ron Howard, and you may know Ron. Ron Howard is one of my favorite figures in Hollywood of all time. I'm like, this kid caught lightning in a bottle. How do you go from being Opie on the Andy Griffith Show, huge success, to being Richie Cunningham on the Happy Days, huge success, to being one of the most sought-after producers in Hollywood? Your brother Clint is in all your movies. Your daughter Bryce Dallas Howard goes on to be a Hollywood success. And I can't speak for you. I don't recall the tabloid stories about Ron Howard. This dude has arguably had the most impressive Hollywood career of all time. But in 2000, he directed this live action version of How the Grinch Stole Christmas with Jim Carrey in the lead role. Then in 2018, The Grinch returned to the animation realm. This time, Benedict Cumberbatch was the voice of The Grinch. Combined, it made about $511.8 million worldwide at the box office. This makes it the highest grossing Christmas movie of all time. Yes, The Grinch That Stole Christmas is that movie. But I want to transition into the movie and talk about that before we get out of here, because there were a couple of things that just really jumped out at me with that one. You know, he didn't want to sell, Dr. Seuss did not want to sell the film rights for his books. He was notorious for that. But following his death in 1991, that decision fell into the hands of his widow, Audrey Giselle. And she put a lot of thought into, well, how do I go about this? If I did sell off the rights to this, if I did auction the rights to this, how would I do it? So she was willing to do it, but here are some of the things that she insisted upon if you wanted to make this movie. Producers had to be willing to give her 4% of the box office gross. They had to give her half of the merchandising revenue. They had to give her 70% of the profit from book tie-ins. All of that on top of the $5 million price tag for the source material itself. Go ahead, Giselle, get your money. Everybody else is. In addition to the monetary concerns, and this is wild, she actually stipulated that the actor playing the role of the Grinch had to have the same level, get this, the same level of status as an actor as either Robin Williams or Jim Carrey. Those are the two names she actually used. And if you think about it, I didn't think about it until I read this. other than Jim Carrey, I think Robin Williams is the only person that could have pulled off such a bombastic, outrageous, outlandish depiction of the Grinch. Those are the two people that she ended up, that she said she wanted this actor to have this equal gravitas to. And of course, Carrey ended up with the role. But you really want to trip out? The two names that kept coming up when they talked about producing The Grinch That Stole Christmas as a movie, Eddie Murphy and Jack Nicholson. Eddie Murphy and Jack Nicholson. Listen, if you look at my Mount Rushmore of entertainers, the first two you will see will be Eddie Murphy and Tupac. Okay? Very few people are a bigger fan of Ed than I am, other than his mama, his daddy, and his brother, God rest his soul. But Eddie Murphy as the Grinch, somebody was just grabbing at straws because of his popularity. As much as I love him, that just doesn't fit. As I said a second ago, the two actors that she pointed to, I think she was spot on. And Jack Nicholson as the Grinch, I mean, I think they saw him play the Joker, and he played that dark character. Can Colonel Jessup put the green makeup on? Can Colonel Jessup stare down the Whoville and, you know, you want me on that wall. You need me on that wall. I don't see it. I absolutely don't see it. But those two things had me rolling. But when I talk about donning the green makeup, the makeup, the prosthetics, the process, that entire subject was the thing that almost single-handedly sunk the film How the Grinch Stole Christmas. If you think about Jim Carrey, there were no scenes where Jim Carrey was not in makeup. Every single scene he shot, he had to be put in his Grinch costume. And so over the course of 5 months of principal photography, he went on to wear that suit for 92 days out of the total. 92 days out of 5 months. Now, what does that mean? Okay, Marcus, he was in costume for 92 days out of 5 months. Think about this. The first time the makeup team put that suit on him, it took them about 8.5 hours. I'm going to pause for emphasis on that one. As we say in the hood, let that marinate. 8.5 hours. There are legendary stories about Jim Carrey kicking a hole in his trailer because he was so frustrated at this arduous process. Now, over time, they were able to cut it down to putting it on in 3 hours and taking it off in one, which was an improvement, but Carrey still wasn't cool with it. It was a lot. He had to do a lot of prosthetics with the mask, which was a lot from the neck up, but he never dealt with anything this overbearing on his physical person. And as much as Jim Carrey has been involved with films that kind of stretch him physically, this was just too much. How much was it too much? He told Ron Howard it felt like he was being buried alive every time they did it. And in a literal sense, so much so, so frustrated was Carrey with this, Ron Howard had to hire a CIA expert, hear me clearly, a CIA expert to teach Jim Carrey how to relax under duress. Because when he said he felt like he was being buried alive, he was experiencing that level of claustrophobia every time they covered him from head to toe with this heavy prosthetic. And Carrey goes on to say that it worked well enough for him that he had fewer issues. He still felt some kind of way from time to time. And to this very day, he credits that training for a good amount of his Zen mentality. And apparently, rumor has it that he still utilizes those teachings today. But now the makeup artist who was in charge of that, head artist, Kazuhiro Tsuji, I want to say T-S-U-J-I. He was the head makeup artist. This was a difficult process for him. While Carrey was having these meltdowns, he was the one who had to face Jim Carrey, kicking a hole in his trailer. He's coming back, and you got to be the guy to try to say, calm down, let me put this next layer on. It wasn't easy for this man. He still had to maintain a consistent quality across this massive cast for the project, and he was able to handle it and finish the film. But he actually needed therapy to recover from the mental stress and duress of Jim Carrey's discomfort and emotional fallout. In his mind, this was not a happy memory whatsoever. In total, over 1,000 plus hours was spent applying makeup and prosthetics to not just Jim Carrey, but to all the Who's in Whoville and the Grinch. When you go back and you look at the movie, some of those characters look normal, but a lot of them have prosthetics, the nose, the lips, other areas. Because of this work, though, because of the commitment of that one department, the one area that, again, was a make-or-break area for this movie, the makeup artistry was credited as being the one thing that really made it stood out, really made it stand out, I should say. It was credited as being the movie with the most makeup used overall, taking the title away from The Wizard of Oz. The Grinch would have completely failed were it not for this committed team. The film's single Academy Award, the only Academy Award won by this movie, won for best makeup and hairstyling, serving as a permanent reminder of their hard work. And so for all the things that I read about the movie, the... the stipulations of Dr. Seuss's widow, I absolutely love, because in a capitalistic society, if you don't know what you want, trust me, other people will line up to take what you deserve. Bravo to her. And again, the makeup and that whole process fascinated me because I didn't realize that it really served as the foundation for the show's success. And if they couldn't fight through that, the film was a wash. This is how classy Ron Howard is. After recognizing the troublesome nature of this process, he wanted Jim Carrey to realize and recognize just how grateful he was that he overcame and he fought through the discomfort and he delivered this phenomenal performance as the Grinch. To show that appreciation, Howard arrived at work at 3:30 in the morning toward the end of filming and endured the same Grinch makeup experience that Carrey had gone through each day. And so he literally put himself in Jim Carrey's shoes and went through the process just to say thank you. Listen, ladies and gentlemen, that may be one of several reasons why Ron Howard to this very day and throughout cinematic history is one of, if not the most successful that Hollywood has ever seen. The Grinch that stole Christmas. These are some of the things that I bet you didn't know. Some of those things you looked at the radio and said, yeah, I knew that. Other things you said, were that happened? Yeah. Yeah. All of that to bring us the special that brings us so much joy over the years and holiday through holiday through holiday. And so it gave me joy as a kid. It now brings myself joy, my wife, my children, and we love it. And so listen, that's our show for today. You can tune in next time for more discussion and analysis with local and national guests. Remember that Next 2.0 streams on Fridays on all major podcast platforms and the fourth Sunday of the month at 4 p.m. on WQLN NPR, which is 91.3 FM. I'm Marcus Atkinson. Come and join us again next year, if you will, so that you can hear about what's next for our communities and our democracy on behalf of the public's voice and WQLN NPR PBS. Let me say happy holidays to you and your family. Thank you all so much for joining us, and thank you for being constant listeners. We will see you next time. Peace on earth.